speaking the Word of God on this program is Brother David Farr.
In the series relative to lessons from Bible characters, my assignment has to do with the life of Joseph. I'm thankful, of course, that people have a knowledge of the Bible. But for one reason, I somewhat wish that you didn't know anything about Joseph when you came tonight. I know you do. I know you know the story. But it would be a delightful experience for me or anybody else to have the opportunity to just tell the story of Joseph to people who had never heard it before. Because for sheer drama, it is unsurpassed. Now, we've learned it since we were quite young, and so the various turns of events in the story, we sort of take for granted that we know. But if you stop and think about it, it is one of the most exciting stories that you'll find anywhere in the Scriptures or elsewhere. Now, it's a rather remarkable thing. I don't know whether you've noticed this or not, but the book of Genesis, 50 chapters, the first book of the Bible, covers the history of the world for its first 3,000 years. So 3,000 years are compressed into just 50 chapters. But the story of Joseph takes up almost one-fourth of the book of Genesis. He only lived 110 years in comparison to the 3,000 years that the book covers, and yet his 110 years takes up almost one-fourth of the space allotted to the first 3,000 years of history. Rather than going through in order the details of the story, since I think you will basically know them, I thought I would just tonight make some points relative to the experiences of Joseph and God's part in connection with him, as well as the involvement of certain others, and just sort of develop some principles, some thoughts that can be gained from the events themselves. And I will talk about some of the things that happened, but if you want a through reading of the story, you can go home and just start in about chapter 37, and most everything from 37 on will have to do in one way or another with Joseph. Chapter 38 doesn't have much, but most of the rest from 37 to 50. Now, here was a touching story of a father and his son. Joseph was the first son of Jacob's favorite wife, and therefore his favorite son. And you know, of course, about the problems that developed in the family that we'll mention again in a moment because of this showing of favoritism. Everybody remembers about him giving him the coat of many colors. Now, I have four children, and if you ask me which one of the four is my favorite, I not only will have the tact not to give you an answer, but I couldn't give you an answer if I wanted to. But Jacob had a favorite son. And this traces back to the fact of polygamy, that he was married to more than one woman. And his favorite wife was the one who produced his favorite son. It would seem that it would be rather easy for such a thing to happen in that kind of circumstance. Polygamy in the Old Testament is a reality. It is baffling sometimes to us to understand why God tolerated some of those things. He certainly did not intend that they be, and neither does He intend the practice of polygamy in our times. But it is widespread. Now, I'm not just referring to those renegade Mormons in their practice of polygamy. There is some of that, and they would actually call it that. But most of the polygamy in America is one wife at a time with the formality of a divorce in between, but it's still polygamy. It's having several wives. And when that kind of thing develops and there are children by different wives, I can see how a thing could develop where there would be favorite children or a favorite child. When Joseph had been sold by his brothers into slavery and a false report had been given to their father that caused him to believe that Joseph had been killed by a wild beast and his body eaten, we see something of the heaviness that came to the heart of this father. He said, "I'll go down to my grave in mourning." Now, the fact is that Joseph wasn't dead. But here is an illustration of how that a person can believe something and believe something so sincerely that it is real to him, even though it is untrue. You have sometimes people today who will talk about, I sincerely believe this, and they think because they sincerely believe it, that makes it right. And there are some folks who don't even want to know what the Bible actually teaches because they're satisfied with what they believe in their hearts. Jacob really believed that Joseph was dead, but he was deceived. He believed a lie. And it turned out later that he learned the truth, but for 22 years he lived with the sorrow that he had sent his favored and favorite son on a mission that led to his death. And when Joseph allowed himself to be known by his brothers all those years later down there in Egypt, if you read the text, you'll notice that the very first thing he wanted to know was about his father. 22 years hadn't dulled the affection that the son had for the father, nor the love the father had for the son. So here is a touching story in and of itself of the love of a parent and child. And while favoritism is not right, and the polygamy that led to that situation was not right, we still can appreciate the kind of relationship that parents and children can and should have. Now, following right along with that, it's not only the touching story of the love of a father and son, but it is also the sad story of family strife. Two words that ought to always have the connotation of peace and happiness and joy are the words home and family. But here was a home, here was a family that tragically was wrecked from within by the strife that developed between these brothers. Why, his brothers, they were by different mothers, and they didn't feel the kind of kinship toward him that they might have felt toward one another. and they came to where they were not only envious and jealous of him, but they hated him. And that hatred caused murder to be in their hearts. And you know the story, of course, of how that they sold him into slavery. And the only reason they didn't kill him is because the oldest of the boys did have enough presence of mind to see that that was something that surely they ought not to do. But he still went along with the deception that was passed on to Jacob when they brought the coat back to him. Well, I wonder how they must have felt for the next 22 years when they saw their father stooped over under the burden of grief, when they realized the hours that he must have cried through the night, and they knew that they were altogether to blame for it, that they had brought this ruin to their own family because of their hatred and jealousy. But now we go to the part of the story that gets exciting. You see, here is an amazing story of, well, it's what we'd call a rags-to-riches story. Because the story of Joseph is a story of a series of advances and then reverses, and advances and reverses. He's a favored son in a wonderful home situation for himself. And there was prosperity, and there was all the necessities and luxuries that age could provide, but abruptly it's cut off and he sold into enslavement. And he's just a young boy, just a teenager. But there are some qualities that are good about him, and the man that bought him soon recognized that here was someone who would be useful, and so he began to give him more and more responsibility before long in a very short time. This teenage boy had worked his situation. He may have gone out of his teen years by then, but he had worked his situation to where he was so respected and appreciated that he was the head of the whole household. This was a obviously prosperous family, a house of a prominent man, and here is this slave boy that's over it all. But you know that the bottom fell out of that when he was falsely accused. And so, going from a good home to enslavement, going to a good position, now he's in prison. I can't even imagine the despondency that would have to go into a person in that kind of circumstance. We're not told anything about his feelings or what he thought about or whether he was for a time bitter and got over it. We just don't know about that at all. We can imagine some things about how anybody might feel in that kind of situation. But somebody said, and this is just for the purpose of illustrating the point, somebody said, he looked around in his cell there in the jail, and he saw it was dirty, and he asked the jailer, could you let me have a broom so I could sweep up a little bit? And he may have started cleaning up his cell and said, you know, if you'll trust me, let me just sweep down the whole place. But anyway, it wasn't long till the jailer saw that this condemned young man had qualities that would be of use to him and his responsibilities. And so Joseph, even though it was in a jail, he worked his way up till he was at the top again. And then you know how that the butler and the baker of Pharaoh had dreams that they wanted him to interpret, and he made sure they understood it was God that gave the meaning, but he did explain to them, he explained to the butler that he'd be restored to his place with Pharaoh, and sadly to the baker that he would be hanged, the birds would eat his flesh. Both of the dreams, of course, were prophetic. They came to pass. he made a request of the butler. In effect, he said, I am unjustly imprisoned here. You're going back to a position of influence with Pharaoh the king, and remember me. Remember what I've done here. Remember how I've befriended you. And we take it that probably they had a much closer relationship than simply that on one occasion they talked and he told them the dream. They were in jail together, in the prison together. But whatever the circumstance was, and no matter how much Joseph may have had his hopes, that now I've made a contact, I may get out of this situation now. I've worked hard. I've done what's right. And maybe everything will turn out all right now. And the butler went back to Pharaoh. And I can sort of imagine Joseph from just the human standpoint. He thinks about the butler now. He's back in the presence of the king. And a week goes by. 2 weeks goes by. And maybe Joseph thinks, well, he hasn't had the opportunity yet to talk to Pharaoh, but he will, and another week or two and a month. The butler never said anything to Pharaoh for 2 years in order to try to help Joseph. Joseph just has to stay in the prison. But then you know that when he was 30 years of age, Pharaoh has those dreams that were prophetic concerning the economy of the land of Egypt. And when the butler realizes the desperation of Pharaoh, now, it wasn't any sense of gratitude that he had for what Joseph had done for him. There wasn't any friendship toward Joseph that was involved here. He told about Joseph, not for Joseph's benefit, but because he saw the desperation of the king. And then this boy that had lost his good family setting, then lost his situation with the household of Potiphar, and has lost his opportunity, he thought, in regard to the butler that he had befriended, he comes into a circumstance where he becomes the prime minister of the entire land of Egypt. He's just 30 years of age. Sometimes we hear a story about somebody that grows up in our country in poverty, and they say, you know, he was born out here and they didn't have anything and he just didn't have any opportunities, but he worked and worked, and now that he's 70 years old, he's worth $1 million. But here's a fella, he's 30 and he's over the entire land of Egypt with the exception of the throne itself. A rags to riches story. Without question. But now let me tell you something else. It's not only a touching story of a father and son's love for each other, and a sad story of family strife, and an amazing story of rags to riches, so to speak. It's also an exemplary story of purity and integrity. Now, we don't have any record of the training that Joseph received growing up. But somewhere he learned what was right. And he never forgot it. In spite of the reverses that he experienced, which in themselves would be a temptation, he never forgot what is right in regard to moral and ethical conduct. Now the thing you first of all think about is how that he's there in Potiphar's house, and he's tempted, of course, by Potiphar's wife. She tries to seduce him, but prior to that, you have to appreciate the fact that he's of such integrity that even though he is a servant, that has been sold into this circumstance against his will and might be considered by anybody as being maybe a little dangerous and suspect, Potiphar sees that he's a person that can be trusted 100%. And it even came to the place, the record says, that Potiphar didn't even know his own affairs because he trusted that Joseph would take care of everything. And in the matter of the enticements from Mrs. Potiphar, they must have been toward this young man, a young man who had, from a fleshly standpoint, the right, now emphasize, from the fleshly standpoint, the right to do anything toward these Egyptian people. And he was young and strong and had the natural inclinations that biologically would go with that circumstance and age. And here is a woman that is enticing him with a temptation that perhaps could be described as the strongest kind of enticement that a young man could ever have to deal with. Now, sometimes today they talk about temptations in the workplace. Now, this was a temptation in the workplace. He worked there. He had to be there. And what a temptation it was. But I want you to notice that first of all, he refused. Three R's. You know, you talk about the three R's in school. Well, here are the three R's of dealing with temptation. He refused, and then he reasoned, and then he ran. Now, first of all, there's just the refusal. No, he's not going to commit this sin. And then he reasoned with Potiphar's wife. And the reasoning was like this, that Potiphar has put everything under my control, and I have it all except for you, but you belong to him. You don't belong to me. And aside from the moral implications from the issue of sexual purity, there was the integrity that recognized that this kind of sin was not simply that would involve these two people. It involved someone else. And he didn't have a right to take that which belonged to another. Sometimes folks today will excuse their moral infidelity by saying, well, it's just us, it's just our business. The truth of the matter is it always has some effect in regard to other people. And so when she grabbed hold of him to further seduce him, he left his coat and ran. So he refused, he reasoned, and then he ran. And in the New Testament, Paul wrote to Timothy to flee also youthful lusts in 2 Timothy 2 and verse 22. And more directly to this very issue, the apostle wrote to Corinthians in 1 Corinthians 6 verse 18, flee fornication. And that's what Joseph was doing. But when we think about his purity and integrity, there's another interesting thing. I don't think it would have been a temptation at all to not tell the butler what his dream meant. But I'll tell you, it would have been hard to tell the baker what his dream meant. I think that there would be a temptation to soft soap that thing and to make up something and go some other way with it. But this fella had the integrity that even though the truth hurt, he still had to tell the truth. Paul asked one time, you remember, am I become your enemy because I tell you the truth? So he was not an enemy of the baker, but the truth was the truth. And I think there's a lesson there for us today in dealing with people on the issue of gospel truth and salvation and the judgment and heaven and hell, that we speak the truth, not with the purpose of hurting someone. And Colossians 4:6 says, "Let your speech be always with grace, seasoned with salt, that you may know how you ought to answer every man." But at the same time, there isn't any way to portray sin except as sin. And there isn't any way to define hell except as hell. And there's not another meaning to the word lost except lost. And the only way of salvation is the way that is in Jesus Christ, the plan of the gospel. Then when he got to be the head politician of the whole land, except for the king, he's still a man of integrity. And there is never the slightest hint that at any time he took dishonest advantage of his position, either in dealing with what belonged to Pharaoh's business, or in dealing with the people. Now, he was a shrewd business person. And when he got through, Pharaoh, and he was acting in behalf of Pharaoh, owned everything. Now, he didn't cause the people to rebel over it. As a matter of fact, the people were grateful to him because he worked out an economic system that would work for them and at the same time would bring security to the land, and the people recognized it. But now, in all of this, all Joseph was doing was simply proceeding in the proper way as a person of integrity. The world today needs integrity, not only in religious issues, but in all matters. Brother Melton and I were talking briefly on our way down here about how that there's sometimes folks that don't pay their bills. I can tell you that the folks that my wife deals with, 99% of them are very honest, and there's not ever a problem. But there will always be one or two somewhere, supposed to be Christians, that don't see that there's any need to be honest in their dealings. And that's tragic. And that's as much sin as would have been the sin that Joseph might have committed with Potiphar's wife. Well, I don't want to get too far off on that because I'm going to run out of time, but I felt like preaching there for a moment, so. All right. I'm looking at my notes because I know our time is limited. But I've talked about this being a touching story of a father and son, a sad story of family strife, an amazing story of rags to riches, an exemplary, that is, there's an example in it, a story of purity and integrity. Now, let's notice and never forget that this is a faith-building story of God's presence. You see, that's the key to the whole thing. God was with him. In the 39th chapter, and verses 2 and 3, this is especially emphasized. Here is Joseph down in Egypt. He's now a slave in Potiphar's house. And the simple statement in the text is, in verse 2 of Genesis 39, "And the Lord was with Joseph." I'm not even going to read the whole verse. I've got it here, but I just want you to remember just that line. "And the Lord was with Joseph." Then if you look in the fourth verse, you'll see the same point presented again from a different angle. It says that Potiphar saw that the Lord was with Joseph. Now we could branch off right there and talk about how that if the Lord is really with you in your life, other people will see it. And that's a good lesson right there. But right now we want to just emphasize how that all of the success, everything that turned out good, as well as his enduring his trials, all was because Jehovah was with him. In fact, if you left God out of this story, I wouldn't believe it. Just take God out of it and you won't convince me it's true. It's too fantastic to believe. It's just beyond the possibility of it just happening, as people might say, by fate. The only explanation is the presence of God. And Joseph always knew that. There are some points in the story where there isn't any reference made to his thoughts about God. But if you look at the whole thing, all the way down to the closing part of the book of Genesis, you'll see that Joseph was always aware that somehow God has a part in this, and this is his plan. Tremendous faith. And that ought to cause us to recognize how that we can deal with life. We can overcome temptation. We can be successful in living. Maybe not get as rich as Joseph was, but successful in living if God is with us. And you know some beautiful passages that touch on that. The psalmist said, as you well remember, "Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil." Why? "Because thou art with me." Psalm 23, verse 4. And the writer of the book of Hebrews in 13, you remember he said, the Lord said, "I will never leave thee nor forsake thee," so that we may boldly say, "God is my helper, I shall not fear what man shall do unto me." And so you have here a faith-building story. Read the book of Joseph, the story of Joseph in the book of Genesis. Read it with the one thought, the one purpose of how will this make my faith stronger? Because it is a faith-building story. But let me shift your attention in another direction. It's also a graphic story of the workings of a guilty conscience. The conscience is a remarkable thing. Now we have to emphasize to people that the conscience in itself is not the guide in religion. I'm not going to get off on that, but the conscience is not a lawgiver. It doesn't decide what's right. It only acts on what is already understood to be right. So the conscience is not a lawgiver. Somebody said it's not a lawgiver. Neither is it the final judge. Now, it may judge within oneself, but God is the judge. God is the lawgiver. What is the conscience? The conscience is the witness that either testifies for us or against us within us. Now, some folks don't appreciate their conscience. And I don't know that anybody'd appreciate it at the time that it's heavy. You can't say you could enjoy a guilty conscience. Mark Twain had Huckleberry Finn say one time, "A conscience takes up more of a man's insides than anything." And he was in a circumstance where he'd done something wasn't right, and it was really bugged. You know, it just took up more of him than anything. And sometimes it's that. Oh, I think whether we want to talk about it or not, we all have had some times when we couldn't sleep, when we felt great anxiety, when we wished we had things that we could have done over. the conscience at work. Some people will suppress the conscience, thinking that if they can put it out of mind, the problem will go away and the conscience won't be there anymore. And of course, there is such a thing as a seared conscience. And that's a conscience that has been so suppressed that a person doesn't feel its effect, at least at the time. Now think about these brothers. These 10 boys that had sold Joseph into slavery, and then they took his coat, stripped it off, left him at least partially naked, and turned him over to these foreign heathen men to take him down there, and as far as they knew, he'd die pretty soon anyway. They were really, most of them, willing to kill him on the spot anyway. Then took that coat back and let their father suffer that anguish for 22 years. And we're not given any details about it. Somebody writing a novel on this or a story of fiction would have to elaborate extensively about the various feelings and experiences they had. We don't have that in the Scriptures, but we know human nature. And don't you know that when Levi's wife sent for him that they had a child that was seriously sick, that Levi must have thought about Joseph? Oh, I don't know of any particular event like that. I just know things like that happen. And can't you imagine that when Judah was afraid that his business enterprises were going to fail and he was about to suffer a bankruptcy and ruin for himself and his family, that he was at, why is this happening? And before he could finish the question, he's thinking, because of what we did to Joseph. But time passes, and time smooths it over. And after a year, 5 years, it probably wasn't something they thought of very much. 22 years later. 22 years after the crime had been committed, when the conscience, having been dismissed over and over again, would seem to be dormant in regard to this. It's dead now. Accused them of being spies, and then said the only way you can clear yourselves is that younger brother, Benjamin, that you left at home. Bring him down here and let me see him. They knew that wouldn't do. They knew that Father Jacob wouldn't allow that. And besides, they were told they were going to have to all but one of them stay in prison until he got there. And what did they say? They said, "Oh, this fellow Joseph's a mean old man." No, they didn't say that. No, they said, "Well, why do we have the worst luck of anybody in this part of the world?" No, they didn't say that. They said what had been on their hearts off and on for 22 years. They said, "We are verily guilty concerning our brother." And Reuben, who had halfway tried to prevent that whole episode 22 years ago, he had to pour some salt in the wounds. He said, "I told you back then." This is a graphic story of the working of a guilty conscience. Then, very quickly, we have here also, and my eyes get dim and I can't see everything I've written here without checking with my glasses once in a while. But we have here also the remarkable story of God's preservation of this family and nation. Over in the 15th chapter of Acts, James made the statement, "Known unto God are all His works from the beginning of the creation." And God knew all about this before it ever happened. They didn't know it as it was happening. He hadn't told them the details, but God knew about it. And in the 15th chapter of Genesis, when he was making a covenant with Abram, he pointed out in general terms how these things would develop. And it was all coming to pass exactly as God had said that it would, that much of it at that time. You see, God had a plan for the redemption of mankind that involved Abraham and his descendants, descendants through Isaac, Jacob, ultimately Judah. Joseph was not in a direct line of Christ. And you might wonder, well, why do you have a fourth of the book of Genesis taken up the story of a man that wasn't even in the ancestry of Jesus? The simple answer is, it is one more demonstration of the working of God in carrying out his scheme of redemption that involved throughout their history a special preservation of the family and the nation. In the first place, the miraculous birth of Isaac, so that there would even be a seed from Abraham that would fit the promise and the prophecy. And then the story of Joseph, of course, as Joseph brought out on more than one occasion, was simply a story of God preserving this family and keeping them alive and keeping them in the right circumstance. If we go on through the Bible, we'll find the deliverance from Egypt of their descendants when it came time for them to come out of Egypt to go to the land of Canaan. We could talk about the Babylonian exile and the return from exile, again, God's preservation of the nation. The remarkable book of Esther, an interesting and there again an amazing story. And yet the whole point of it is God's preserving these people so that there would be this line, this remnant through whom Christ would come into the world. And even up to the early years of Jesus, his preservation in being taken down into Egypt. It's interesting that statement regarding what happened to Israel coming out of Egypt is applied to Christ going to Egypt and coming back. In Hosea 11:1, out of Egypt have I called my son, and Matthew applies that specifically to Jesus, while Hosea originally was pointing it back to what God had done in delivering the whole nation. But the point of the thing is that it all fits together. Now, why were they down there? Why did God want them down there in Egypt to start with? It wasn't just to get them down there so he could bring them out. He promised Abraham the land of Canaan. That was the land promise. Genesis 12 and the subsequent places. But they could not have grown to be a great nation in the land of Canaan without interference from the Canaanite tribes that lived there. They had to go somewhere else to develop as a nation. Providence of God. They got down there into Egypt, and there they settled in the land of Goshen, which was an isolated area from the rest of the Egyptians. It was a good place to live, but it wasn't simply because it was a good place for their flocks and herds. God didn't want them intermarrying with the Egyptians, so he put them in a separate place. But it was a fertile and a good land. Why was it that they were able to have it instead of the Egyptians having such land? And the answer we learn partly from Scripture and partly at least the terminology from secular history is because this was a period of time in Egyptian history when Egyptians weren't ruling the land of Egypt. A line of kings that's called in history the Hyksos kings. Some call them the shepherd kings. Not sure whether that's correct terminology or not, but we do know from various ancient things, monuments and all, that there was a period when the Egyptians were thrown out of the government. That is, the Pharaoh was a foreigner who somehow got in control. And then when Joseph wanted his family settled in a choice land, this man who was the Pharaoh, who wasn't even an Egyptian in the real sense anyway, he was certainly willing to go along with it, because he could appreciate them as Joseph people more than he could the Egyptians. That explains why under his authority Joseph took over everything that belonged to Egyptians, because Pharaoh was not of the same nationality as the people over which he ruled at that time. But when you start in the book of Exodus, you remember it says there arose a Pharaoh who knew not Joseph. Now, does that mean he just, they had a new Pharaoh, didn't have a very good memory, and nobody tell him anything? Well, of course not. That was the return of the Egyptians themselves ruling their own country, and certainly he would not know, in the sense of having respect for, the history of Joseph, when Joseph had been the one used by that other Pharaoh to take over everything. But all of this is in the providence of God. It's interesting history. It's an exciting story. But it is simply God making sure that his people, this family and the nation that would come from them, would be preserved with one purpose. That in the preservation of this family and nation. Over in the 15th chapter of Acts, James made the statement, "Known unto God are all his works from the beginning of the creation." And God knew all about this before it ever happened. They didn't know it as it's happening. He hadn't told them the details, but God knew about it. And in the 15th chapter of Genesis, when he was making a covenant with Abram, he pointed out in general terms how these things would develop. And it was all coming to pass exactly as God had said that it would, that much of it at that time. You see, God had a plan for the redemption of mankind that involved Abraham and his descendants, descendants through Isaac, Jacob, ultimately Judah. Joseph was not in a direct line of Christ. And you might wonder, well, why do you have a fourth of the book of Genesis taken up the story of a man that wasn't even in the ancestry of Jesus? The simple answer is, it is one more demonstration of the working of God in carrying out his scheme of redemption that involved, throughout their history, a special preservation of the family and the nation. In the first place, the miraculous birth of Isaac, so that there would even be a seed from Abraham that would fit the promise and the prophecy. And then the story of Joseph, of course, as Joseph brought out on more than one occasion, was simply a story of God preserving this family and keeping them alive and keeping them in the right circumstance. If we go on through the Bible, we'll find the deliverance from Egypt of their descendants when it came time for them to come out of Egypt to go to the land of Canaan. We could talk about the Babylonian exile and the return from exile, again, God's preservation of the nation. The remarkable book of Esther, an interesting and there again an amazing story. And yet the whole point of it is God's preserving these people so that there would be this line, this remnant through whom Christ would come into the world. And even up to the early years of Jesus, his preservation in being taken down into Egypt. It's interesting that statement regarding what happened to Israel coming out of Egypt is applied to Christ going to Egypt and coming back. In Hosea 11:1, out of Egypt have I called my son. And Matthew applies that specifically to Jesus, while Hosea originally was pointing it back to what God had done in delivering the whole nation. But the point of the thing is that it all fits together. Now, why were they down there? Why did God want them down there in Egypt to start with? It wasn't just to get them down there so He could bring them out. He promised Abraham the land of Canaan. That was the land promise. Genesis 12 and the subsequent places. But they could not have grown to be a great nation in the land of Canaan without interference from the Canaanite tribes that lived there. They had to go somewhere else to develop as a nation. Providence of God. They got down there into Egypt, and there they settled in the land of Goshen, which was an isolated area from the rest of the Egyptians. It was a good place to live, but it wasn't simply because it was a good place for their flocks and herds. God didn't want them intermarrying with the Egyptians, so He put them in a separate place. But it was a fertile and a good land. Why was it that they were able to have it instead of the Egyptians having such land? And the answer we learn partly from Scripture and partly at least the terminology from secular history is because this was a period of time in Egyptian history when Egyptians weren't ruling the land of Egypt. A line of kings that's called in history the Hyksos kings. Some call them the shepherd kings. Not sure whether that's correct terminology or not. But we do know from various ancient things, monuments and all, that there was a period when the Egyptians were thrown out of the government. That is, the Pharaoh was a foreigner who somehow got in control. And then, when Joseph wanted his family settled in a choice land, this man who was the Pharaoh, who wasn't even an Egyptian in the real sense anyway, he was certainly willing to go along with it because he could appreciate them as Joseph people more than he could the Egyptians. That explains why under his authority, Joseph took over everything that belonged to Egyptians because Pharaoh was not of the same nationality as the people over which he ruled at that time. But when you start in the book of Exodus, you'd remember it says there arose a Pharaoh who knew not Joseph. Now does that mean they had a new Pharaoh, didn't have a very good memory and nobody tell him anything? Well, of course not. That was the return of the Egyptians themselves ruling their own country. And certainly, he would not know in the sense of having respect for the history of Joseph when Joseph had been the one used by that other Pharaoh to take over everything. But all of this is in the providence of God. It's interesting history. It's an exciting story. But it is simply God making sure that His people, this family and the nation that would come from them, would be preserved with one purpose, that in the fullness of time He might send forth His Son to redeem us, as I paraphrase Galatians 4, verse 4. So we've thought about touching story of a father and his son, sad story of family strife, an amazing story of rags to riches, an exemplary story of purity and integrity, a faith-building story of God's presence, and the remarkable story of God's preservation of the family and the nation. And then we have a story through it all that is a beautiful demonstration of forgiveness. When I was a teenager and assigned various things to read in high school, I remember reading The Count of Monte Cristo. And I've seen a movie version of it on TV since then. And frankly, and I guess this is a confession of the wrong attitude in me, but I always enjoyed when he finally got out of the dungeon and finally got rich and finally got some power and got even with all those people that mistreated him. Boy, it just made me feel good. And you know, if I were writing the story of Joseph from a fleshly perspective and left God out of it, boy, it'd have been bad on those boys that sold him. I mean, they'd have got what was coming to them, don't you think? Not Joseph. Now, they didn't fear too much once they got down there and their father was alive. He was a shield, they thought. But when old Jacob died, I can just imagine. I don't know whether they lived on the same street or the same neighborhood. I don't know. But I just have to imagine that they all gathered maybe at Reuben's house since he was the oldest. And they got in there and they said, "Now, we've got a problem. Father's not alive anymore to protect us, and what are we going to do?" And so they had the attitude right. I think this would have been Jacob's attitude, but it seems that they made up part of it, and they went to Joseph, and they said, "Now, your father, our father, said for you to forgive us." They were begging for forgiveness. And Joseph didn't take advantage of the situation. Joseph simply said, "Now, you meant to do me wrong, but God had a plan in this. And He used this to save much people alive." And in effect, He simply said to them, "Brothers, you are the sons of my father. Oh, what you did was wrong, but that's a long time ago, and I long ago gave up any hard feelings I had, and you're forgiven." Didn't use that word, but that's what it amounted to. And so we have here a story, a beautiful story of forgiveness. And you know, our Savior said to us that if we forgive others, we can be forgiven. If we refuse to forgive others, we can't be forgiven. About 3 years ago, I baptized a man. It was on a Saturday morning. He had heard the gospel preached in a meeting and had never prior to that shown much interest in spiritual things, but it happened that I finished the meeting on Friday and left town to go to another city in another state for another meeting on Saturday evening. And he didn't know that I'd gone. So the first part of the week he called to see where I was. My wife told him, and when will he be back? But anyway, I got back in about 4 days and he was waiting to be baptized. He almost drove to the other town. But I talked with him just before we went into the baptistry. He said, "There's just one thing that I've got a problem with." I said, "What's that?" He said, "There is someone that I'm going to have a hard time forgiving." I didn't know what he was talking about. I've learned since then, and the way that I've learned it is in talking with him about how it doesn't bother him anymore. He got over it. And he's relieved. And well, the man, to my knowledge, that did him this harm hadn't repented. And so forgiveness is not complete. But this brother's attitude is such that he's not carrying the hurt that he carried before. We talk about the golden rule, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. That's of course a good rule, but you know the Bible's got a platinum rule. Platinum's worth more than gold. The platinum rule is not merely that you do unto others as you would have them do unto you, but you do unto others as Christ has done to you. Ephesians 4, verse 32. Be ye kind one to another, tenderhearted, forgiving one another, even as God for Christ's sake has forgiven you. The story of Joseph ends the book of Genesis as a story, a beautiful story of forgiveness. Thank you for your wonderful attention tonight. I sure have enjoyed this. I hope you have too.